Session number 12268, Mr. Charles Biedman, Reel 6.
Charles Biedman, Reel 6.
It was equivalent of 200 weights. In a sense, this work on sugar might well have helped save lives, because we used to tear the bags open with our hooks. There were two stevedore hooks, one short one and one long one, in order to never get grip on bags. And then eat sugar, cast sugar with a handful all day long. The Japanese used to try and stop us, but this was quite impossible. I'm certain I couldn't eat a bowl of sugar today, however hard I tried. But under those conditions, when you were semi-starved, you just ate it. And I'm informed that medically, under those conditions, the carbohydrate becomes a protein sparer. The body really is quite astounding the way it would adapt, if it possibly can, to help survival. We also used to smuggle a lot of the sugar back into camp. Although the Japanese used to search us every time we came into camp, they never did discover how we got it in. And the way we did it was to make long pockets on the inside of our trousers, and then we could fill the sugar into these pockets. And if the Japanese came along and tried to examine you, they could pat you, but the sugar would adapt to the shape of your leg. And so they never did discover. They knew we got sugar in, and some of the Japanese guards used to take advantage of it by asking us to smuggle stuff in for them, and would perhaps do small favours for us in return. And while we were there in the camp, we always did have news of the war. One or two of the men worked in the Japanese quarters, and so could very often smuggle the paper out, or the Japanese would throw the papers away, and they could tear out the maps. So although we couldn't read the kanji, pictorial aspects of Japanese, we could see the maps where the arrows were pointing. And this gave us a fair indication of how the war was going. And also, astoundingly enough, all through the war, Japanese papers were published in English. And the reason for this is that most Japanese find it much easier to read English than Japanese. For a Japanese to read his newspaper, he has to know at least 3,000 separate characters. And that of itself is quite a feat. So this always did happen. Of course, I've said before how much sort of humour comes in to service life. And we found this even with the Japanese. There was a Japanese cook whose name was Torki-san. And he had a Geordie as a cook and his direction. And this Geordie, whose name was George Bullock, was an ex-miner. Nice individual and quite strong. And Torki-san, who was very proud of his English, although he was Pidgin English, say at least, used to say to him, Georgie Kiowa, which means today, Meshides, what are we going to eat? Lately before same, which meant, what we had in the last day or two, or Sakana, how are you? Sakana means fish. And heaven help you if you didn't understand him, because he thought you were just being awkward. And one night when I was on night duty, because we used to keep somebody on all night long, we still had lots of sick men who were around. This talkie-san, who was also on night duty, said to me, Beedman-san, Kegger, time worried us. The war's very bad. So I agreed with him. And he said, Ima, which means now, toxin, many, wider death. So I said, in Toki-san, Wido, Wako and I don't understand what Wido is. Wido death, he said, Baka, which means fool, you know. And then he began to get cross and said to me very slowly, you know, Ima. So I said, yes, you know, toxon, many, Wido death. Eventually, I realized what he was telling me. He was saying that the war was very bad, and he was saying, you know, that because of the war, there's so many widows. But of course, he had the right word, he wasn't pronouncing correctly. But he was a good natured chap himself, and a lot of them weren't. All the while we were in this camp, we were getting odd people coming in off various convoys. And one I remember in particular, there was a couple of men arrived off a convoy, they were in sort of quite comatose condition, and eventually, although they never did wake or speak, we decided this was sleeping sickness. And so Dr. Barclay and myself, we worked all through one night, just trying to keep him alive, which meant sort of pressing on nerve points underneath the jaw just to make him sort of writhe about in agony and stop him getting into this final sleep. And eventually they both died in the early hours of the morning. And when that happens, you just feel awful, because you put so much time and energy into it, you know, and you just feel drained. And so I never did know their names. I never did hear them speak or anything else, you know. Fortunately, that was the only case that we ever encountered of sleeping sickness. Dealing with your sick man was always sad, because you were so limited in what you could do. I remember one man who was dying, and he couldn't eat particularly, and I went into the kitchen and I said, you know, have you any meat at all? And all they had was about 3/4 pound of meat for the whole camp. And they very kindly sort of took a half of this and sort of turned it into beef stew. And I got back and gave most of it to this bloke. He still died a couple of hours later, but at least perhaps a little happier than he might have been. But you know, they did what they could. And I think I've said before that what I found was men died if they had no will to live. And almost one of the first signs of this was when they became louse infested. And they would, you'd suddenly be conscious that a man was full of lice, and if he took his shirt off, it was crawling with them. And they got to a stage when they just weren't bothered. There was just nothing they were going to do. And then they'd just die. Another odd thing, it seemed to me, was pneumonia. We began to get some pneumonia mainly because, I suppose, we were getting emaciated and our clothes weren't very good. What I didn't realise until then was that pneumonia is infectious, because it's due to a pneumococcus. So once you've got it, it sort of tends to spread. So in a sense, dropping the atom bomb saved us, because if it had gone on much, much longer, again, there were so many difficulties in the way, and more people would have gone. We eventually finished up with a quarter of our regiment who died or were killed.
What, a quarter?
Of the whole regiment.
Yes.
We went out.
So three quarters survived?
Yes. Yes.
Did you not get Red Cross parcels?
No. Red Cross is a strange thing. I think I said originally that one of the reasons I decided to go to Japan was to be in touch with the Red Cross. Well, the first thing the Japanese did was they interned all the Red Cross agents there, because they were not signatories to any treaty at all. Then the Red Cross did send their parcels over, one a month per man. The Japanese decided that the Europeans, you know, and British in particular, were greedy people, and they shouldn't have this one today, so they just kept them. And the whole time I was in Japan, I had about 1.5 Red Cross parcels. And when we did get them, they wouldn't dish out the whole lot. They'd give you little bits and pieces of them. They just thought it was just too good for the business. They hung on and sort of used it themselves or what have you. This is no fault of the Red Cross, I mean, because they interned everybody. So they had no inspection of camps. Eventually, I mean, the Americans, they had no idea where the camps were.
Did you have any contacts outside the camp with ordinary Japanese people? You've explained about the loading on the ships, that work you had. What, was there any other contacts with the Japanese, the ordinary civilian people?
Yes. Another act of bravery I witnessed there too was working on, again, a small ship in the harbour. And a destroyer broke loose from its moorings and swung across towards us. The ship was there with about three barges tied up on the other side. And it came towards us. And as it came towards us, most of us left out the barges to get onto the ship itself. And that was that. Well, in the final event, it missed us. And when we got back to camp, there was one of our men, a Sergeant Bickerstaff, and he had about 6 pounds of meat. And when everybody was scared and running away, he went the other way and went into the ship's galley, and all the Japanese crew had gone out and just took this meat. So again, he dire consequences if ever been discovered, but it was very quick thinking, and he really was a brave man. There's no doubt about that one. It went on. We used to have sort of more contact with the Japanese, generally with the people you worked at. On one occasion, I remember working on a barge full of satsumas, which I quite enjoyed, you know, because it was different, and at least you could eat some of them if you wanted to. So that was that. I used to hate the mundane work. If people weren't very fit, they used to have them just move empty petrol drums something like a mile from stacks up into barges, and they were then sent off to be refilled, etc. Well, this meant sort of kicking these things along, rolling them along, and this mile or so, and that I used to think was awful work. And job, again, another one I didn't like, was working on iron ore, because we used to go to a place called Shimonoseki, which was close by, and there's a big steelworks there, and there was these mountains of ore. They were about 30, 40 foot high, and this we used to shovel and load into trucks, and then you used to go up on the conveyor and eventually into the works and got melted down fire. Well, the trouble was that there were boulders and they were weighing, I suppose, sort of 100 weight, something like, you know, so nothing, it wasn't easy shoveling. And that I used to find sort of reasonably soul-destroying work. But any time I was in the camp and the state of sickness wasn't bad, then I used to go out. But in a sense, as I say, this very hard physical work was probably not a bad thing, you know, because it sort of went through there. There's another occasion when I worked outside. We were sent, just a small party, to an estate, and we were on a hillside cutting fuki. It's F-U-K-I, and that's a pallid form of rhubarb. And in the midst of cutting this, a boy, a Japanese boy about 13, who wasn't particularly well dressed, came up to me and said to me in Japanese, you know, why are you doing this? And I said, well, we're prisoners and, you know, we're just getting this food for the camp. And he said, this is women's work. So he clapped his hands and a group of girls came through and he got them cutting this fuki. And he told me that his grandmother owned this estate and that his father was in the Navy and they hadn't heard from him for a couple of years. And that he himself had been into Shanghai and lived there with his father, who was probably in the diplomatic service. And he knew all about sort of football and cricket and tennis, etc. He was a very nice boy. And I had some foreign coins on me, so I gave them to him. And when we came down for lunch, because it's a Japanese custom that if you work for anybody, they provide you with food at midday, which again are these rice balls which are pressed into a triangular shape and pickled daikon. And he, this little boy, asked the guard if I could share his lunch with him. So he asked the grandmother who was there, and they grinned a bit. And he allowed me to do this, so I had the first meat I'd had in months. And on the occasions I went there, I sort of kept contact with them, and the girls and women used to bring out their photographs of their men who were in the services, and our men would show them their photographs, and they'd all have a little weep because the conditions were near the same. It was at least it was a meeting with normal, reasonable people. The Japanese too were also the women particularly were very scared indeed about the Russians, because we were getting towards the end of the war now, and they felt that if the Russians came, they didn't mind the Americans or the British, but they felt that the Russians came, that they might be in sort of complete and absolute troubles. So when the war did finish, I went to see these people because they'd been kind, and I took them some blankets and things they wouldn't easily be able to get hold of, and drugs like DDT chemicals and some whatever I could get my hands on, let them have it there. And this old lady, she insisted that I came there every evening because she said, do you want to keep an eye on me? And she said, you can drink beer, but she said, don't touch the whiskey, because he said they'll kill you. And indeed it did. It killed a couple of men, because it was just sort of methyl alcohol. And she said, you can bring anybody you like with me. Come and sort of have some meal with us every evening. And that's it. And she was very kind. On one occasion when I went down with a fever, probably due to the euphoria and excitement, she came to the camp, and, you know, just to see if I was all right and if everything was all right. So she did a little bit that she could.
You must have got an idea of how the Japanese were living towards the end of the war, you know, and their privations. Did you sort of get a good idea of that? You sort of indicated earlier that they didn't have an awful lot.
I don't think it's easy, because I mean she was obviously a wealthy lady, because on one occasion I was there, the chief of police of the area was there. So that I think her connections were high.
But were they having a hard time, do you think,
generally? Oh, yes. Because as far as we were concerned, for something like 6 months, we lived on what I thought was almost a proteinless diet. I mean, we just didn't have rice. We went on to millet, which is birdseed. But, I mean, they were being bombed out of existence. And almost every ship in the harbour was bombed.
About the war activity, because you mentioned earlier on the shelters. You were going to tell me.
Oh yes, I'm going to tell you about the shelters.
Yes.
You're ready to start again, aren't you?
When did this bombing start? You know, how soon after you arrived in Japan?
Oh, quite a long time, because we were basically in Japan for what. Two and a quarter years. So it was only really in the last year, in sort of 1944-45, that the bombing was there. There were several naval battles in which the Americans gradually got their superiority, and then they had to hop island to island all the way up. And I've always thought that MacArthur was the best general of the war.
I mean, yes. Montgomery. But I must keep to your own specific experience.
Yes. So they got there, and then they were then within bombing range in places like Okinawa, really were bombing hard. Well, the Japanese authorities realised this, so they had us. Make tunnels in nearby mountains and hills, and although we were a small camp, just over 300, there were several Americans there who were experts with dynamite, because a particular friend of mine was a federal ranger, and they used dynamite a lot to get rid of log jams and things like that, you know, rivers. And then a lot of the Americans grew up using dynamite for various things, and they were expert enough, I mean, to even sort of flatten the floor using dynamite charges. And I personally was never working there, because I think at that stage I was doing more medical work. But they used to start off with 6 foot long chisels and eventually wear them down to nubs of just a few inches. And they dug these tunnels, which were used by the camp and some of the nearby population. And I remember on one particular night, there was a tremendous raid, mostly with napalm, because the majority of houses were wood, so they just set fire to them. And the only defence the Japanese had was just to build or make big fire breaks. And I saw the biggest fire I've ever seen in my life, or ever likely to see, because it stretched for miles across the towns of Moji and Chironsaki. Just everything was on fire. And the commandant released us to assist in the firefighting down below. And so we went into this town, and we found one Japanese officer's mess that almost had a direct hit. And almost every person there, any officer there, was on fire. And I'm certain the majority of them died. But they're very stoical, because I can't remember any one of them even uttering a scream or anything at all. They must have been in dire pain. You know, you've got most of your skin surface burnt, and you suddenly put you over their shoulders to carry you out. Awful. And on another occasion, I passed a house where the roof was about to collapse, because the roofs are very heavy there. They get reasonably torrential rain. In the rainy seasons, and I heard some voices inside, and so I could hear that they were somewhere else or the prisoners. And I said to them, sort of, come out, you know, you idiots, you know, the roof's going to collapse. And one of them said to me, come on in. So I said, well, what do I have to come in for? Look what we found. They found a head of cabbage, and that was worth risking their life for, you know, because they were so hungry. You know, it's hard to realise that now. So you had all that. And then while all this was happening, I suddenly realised that there was one man we'd left in the hospital. It was an American called Wolfberger, who was pretty sick. He'd had massive dysentery and stuff. And so I asked permission to take somebody to the hospital with me and bring him back. It was about 300 yards, I suppose, up a fairly steep hill. We got there and got him up, got him dressed and out, and as we got him out, we'd gone about 50 yards when some bombs dropped, and there was a great sheet of flame in front of us. And when this had died down, we went on, and I cannot remember the name or appearance of the chap that helped me. Can't remember at all. It's just there was somebody there, and he was quite a good individual, because when we had all his planes, he didn't panic or anything else. He stopped in there, but I can't, you know, it's just not there. I suppose I was concentrating on this chap Wolfberger, and an interesting thing about him, this Wolfberger, was one occasion he was discharged from the hospital. The hospital was simply a sort of series of small huts on the opposite side of the road to where this main YMCA building was. And the guard came round on inspection, as they used to, and could smell smoke, tobacco smoke, in this little room. Well, the Japanese weren't allowed to smoke there, rightly so, because it was all wood and you slept on tetomy, which is sort of a compressed floor mat, you know, with a shiny surface to it. And the whole thing's very inflammable. Well, he smelled the smoke, and he said to me, Yes, this guard came in and could smell the tobacco smoke in the air. And he said to me, you know, somebody's been smoking here. And he went to the pillow and picked it up, and there was a packet of cigarettes underneath. We didn't used to get many cigarettes. It was about 3 a month, so they were quite precious to you if you smoked, and most people did then. So he said to me, why is he smoking? So I said, well, he's a bit sort of mad, you know, worried us. At this stage, this chap Wolfberger, who was about 6'3" or 6'4", and at that stage probably weighed about 6 stone, lost his temper. And he said, I want my cigarettes back. And he kept on this. So the guard said to me, discharge him, leave the hospital. So we took him over to the main camp. And he wouldn't stop there. He really got worse. And he said, I'm going to get my cigarettes back. And I said, look, take it easy, because it's so easy to take you out and put a cold hose in you, and you're going to kill you. And he said, I want my cigarettes back. So eventually they sent for the interpreter, who was a little chap, and he listened to him. And to my surprise, he took his cigarette case out, and he offered him a cigarette. And he said to me, that's probably the best cigarette you're ever going to have in your life. So once again, it taught me a lesson, which is live with me, that if you're determined enough, determined to die for what you want, you either get what you want or you die, you know. And he returned to America. And this is the same Wolfberger we rescued out of this great fire. But we could tell then that the war was closing in. It was really closing in. Whether we would have lived is another matter. Because I think most of us sort of felt, you know, if it came to the end, they'd probably sort of shoot the lot of us and finish us off.
Yes, I wonder about your morale after you heard that the war in Europe had ended. You know, that's the news of that.
Yes.
You get the war with Japan was going on. Was that a big thing?
Not really, because we thought the Japanese were quite formidable. It was going to take a long time. And if it hadn't been for the atom bomb, it probably would have taken a couple of years. Because they're very doughty fighters. And if once they got in Japan, you get one range of mountains after another. And it would be very difficult indeed to have gotten through. It was just the sheer shock of the atomic bomb which finished it. And the emperor...